All right, we're diving into some fascinating territory today, ready to explore the world of cruciate ligaments. We're going to talk about the cruciate ligaments chapter from the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook, www.orthopedia.com, edited by Bernstein, Pinney, and Vayette. But before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book.
Absolutely. Always go to the source.
We're going to be focusing on the Orthopedia chapter on cruciate ligament injuries of the knee. And, you know, I've been getting a lot of questions from our listeners who are really eager to understand this topic more deeply.
It's definitely a common area of interest, and for good reason, so much can go wrong.
Exactly. So we're going to be unpacking everything from the basic anatomy and function of these ligaments to how these injuries actually happen, what to watch for in patients, how we diagnose them, what increases someone's risk, and the key things to consider when it comes to treatment. And of course, since we're drawing all of this straight from a peer-reviewed textbook, you can rest assured that the information we're discussing is accurate and evidence-based.
Yeah. Definitely. Always good to rely on solid sources.
So to kick things off, let's start with the fundamentals. What exactly are these cruciate ligaments, and what's with that unique name?
Well, inside each of your knee joints, you've got these two very important ligaments, the anterior cruciate ligament, or as we often call it, the ACL, and the posterior cruciate ligament, you guessed it, the PCL. Now, the term cruciate itself is quite descriptive. It comes from the Latin word crux, which means cross, and that's exactly what these ligaments do. They cross each other within a specific notch in the femur, the thigh bone, called the intercondylar notch. Their full names actually tell you where they attach on your shin bone, or tibia. So the anterior cruciate ligament attaches to the front part of the tibia, while the posterior cruciate ligament, as you might expect, attaches to the back.
So essentially they're like two strong ropes holding things together inside the knee, crossing each other to provide stability.
That's a great way to think about it. And if you look at figures 1 and 2 in the Orthopedia chapter, you can see that the ACL runs diagonally downwards and inwards from the outer part of the femur to the inner front part of the tibia. The PCL, on the other hand, originates a bit more forward on the femur and slopes backwards to attach to the posterior aspect of the tibia.
Okay, that gives us a good mental picture. Now that we know where they are, let's talk about what these cruciate ligaments actually do. What are their primary functions, and how does their cross configuration contribute to that?
Essentially, both the ACL and the PCL are all about preventing the tibia from sliding too far forward or backward in relation to the femur. That's what we call resisting subluxation. So the ACL, as its name suggests, is the primary restraint against the tibia moving too far forward, and the PCL prevents it from sliding too far backward.
That makes sense.
But it's more than just this simple forward and backward stability. Mm-hmm. They also play a really important role in making sure your knee bends and straightens smoothly. We often talk about the knee like it's a simple hinge joint, but the reality is there's more to it than that. There are subtle rotations happening as well, and the cruciate ligaments, especially that ACL, are crucial for guiding these movements.
I see. So they're not just like static ropes holding things in place. They're actively involved in the dynamics of knee movement.
Exactly. If their only role was just to stop that one plane of motion, forward and back, having them oriented more horizontally might actually seem more mechanically efficient. But as you can see in figure 2, they are more vertically oriented, which allows for what we call coupled motion. So as the knee bends, that ACL tightens, preventing too much forward movement of the tibia.
So it's a much more sophisticated system than just a simple stop.
Precisely. It highlights how intricate the design of our knee joint is.
Let's zoom in on the ACL now. Can you walk us through how an ACL injury typically happens? What forces are usually at play?
Okay, so ACL injuries. Those usually happen when there's a force that pushes the tibia forward, relative to the femur, that thigh bone. And often, this is combined with some twisting at the knee, specifically an internal rotation of the tibia. Think of it this way. The ligament tears when it's stretched beyond its limit. That distance between its attachment points, if it becomes greater than what the tissue can handle, that's when you get a tear.
So it's like overstretching a rubber band until it snaps.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. And this commonly happens in situations where there are quick changes in direction, especially in sports, those cutting maneuvers. Imagine a soccer player. They plant their foot to quickly change direction. That foot acts like an anchor for the tibia, but their body's momentum is still going the other way.
Right, that makes sense.
That creates a lot of stress on the knee joint, and the ACL ends up bearing the brunt of that force, which can lead to a tear.
Now, shifting gears to the PCL, could you tell us where it originates and inserts, what force it's primarily working against, and how a PCL injury usually happens?
Sure. So the posterior cruciate ligament, that PCL, starts on the medial femoral condyle. That's the inner side of your thigh bone, right at the knee. And it attaches to the back of your shin bone, just below the knee joint, on what we call the posterior aspect of the proximal tibia. Its main job is to stop the tibia from moving too far backward relative to the femur. It's resisting that posterior translation. Now, PCL injuries, they typically happen when there's a direct force pushing the tibia backward, especially when the knee is bent. The classic example is what we call the dashboard injury. You know, in a car accident, if someone's knee slams into the dashboard, that forces the tibia backwards, and that can cause a PCL tear.
I've definitely heard of that one. It's interesting how the mechanism of injury is so different between the ACL and the PCL.
Exactly. And it's worth noting that the PCL is actually a stronger ligament than the ACL. It can withstand a surprising amount of force, something like 3,000 newtons. To put that into perspective, that's like the force of a small car hitting your knee at low speed. Because it's so strong, it takes a lot more energy to injure it. That's why PCL injuries aren't as common as ACL tears.
So let's walk through a scenario where a patient comes in with a suspected ACL injury. What's the typical story they might tell you, and what signs would be immediately apparent?
Okay, so the classic ACL tear story often involves a non-contact injury. They'll describe a sudden pivoting movement while their foot was planted. Like imagine a basketball player, they plant their foot to cut, or a skier, their ski gets caught and their body twists. Patients will frequently report hearing or feeling a pop right when it happened.
Oh yeah, I've heard that pop is a common symptom.
Exactly. Right after that, there's usually immediate and noticeable pain, and the knee swells up pretty quickly. That's because the knee joint starts to fill with blood, which we call hemarthrosis. And while that blood can make the knee stiff and painful, it can actually also make the knee feel temporarily stable. It's kind of misleading, this false stability, because it might mask the fact that the ligament is actually torn.
That's a really important point about the false stability. So given that, how do you actually go about diagnosing an ACL injury during a physical exam? What's the most reliable test?
The most sensitive test we have for figuring out if someone has an ACL tear is the Lachman test. Here's how it works. The patient lies on their back, knee bent at about 20 to 30 degrees. You stabilize the femur with one hand, usually by holding the thigh just above the knee. Then with your other hand, you grasp the upper part of the tibia, the shin bone, and gently pull it forward. If the Lachman test is positive, you'll feel excessive forward movement of the tibia. What the key is, there's no firm endpoint. You don't feel that normal, abrupt stop that tells you the ACL is intact and doing its job.
So it's not just about how far the tibia moves, but also about how it feels when it moves.
Exactly. The quality of the endpoint is really important. And figure 4 in the orthopedia chapter shows you exactly how to do this test.
All right. So the Lachman test seems critical, but the chapter also mentions that it's not always perfect. What are some instances where the Lachman test might not give you an accurate indication of an ACL tear?
You're right, it's not foolproof. One thing is that the accuracy of the Lachman test depends a lot on the examiner's experience. You know, feeling for that firmness of the endpoint, that's somewhat subjective. Someone with more experience will have a better feel for those subtle differences. Another thing is sometimes you can get a false negative result if there's a piece of bone or cartilage that's broken off and gotten in the way. It can block the tibia from moving forward enough to show that there's instability.
Oh, I see. So it's like a mechanical obstruction.
Exactly. And then you have hamstring muscle spasms, which are pretty common because of the pain from the injury. Since the hamstrings attach to the back of the tibia, when they contract, they'll resist your attempt to pull the tibia forward, basically hiding the ACL deficiency. And as we talked about earlier, if there's a lot of fluid inside the knee joint, that can also cause a false negative.
Right, because that extra fluid limits the space for the tibia to move forward.
Precisely.
So if the Lachman test has these potential limitations, what can an examiner do to increase their confidence in the diagnosis?
One thing that can help a lot is to aspirate the knee joint. Basically, that means using a needle to draw out some of that excess fluid. This makes the patient more comfortable, and when they're more relaxed, those hamstring muscles are less likely to spasm. It also decreases the pressure inside the joint, and as we discussed, that pressure can restrict movement and mask the instability. By removing some fluid, you're essentially giving the tibia more room to move, making it easier to assess the true stability of the joint.
That makes sense. It's like taking the brakes off.
In a way, yes. And another helpful thing is that the color of the fluid you aspirate can give you some valuable information. If it's red, meaning there's blood in it, that's a pretty strong sign that there's a significant injury in the knee.
So even the fluid itself can tell a story.
Exactly. It can point to a tear in the meniscus, especially where it attaches to the joint capsule, a fracture in the cartilage, or even a ligament tear on the kneecap.
Fascinating. Let's switch gears back to the PCL. How does a patient with a PCL injury typically present? What kind of injury mechanism would they describe?
Usually, patients with PCL injuries will tell you they had a direct blow to the front of their knee when it was bent, something that pushed the tibia directly backward. This can lead to that PCL rupture. And again, the classic scenario is that dashboard injury we talked about earlier. You know, in a car accident, that flexed knee hitting the dashboard and driving the tibia posteriorly. And it's helpful to compare this to how ACL injuries might happen in a car accident. If the patient stays in their seat and their knee doesn't hit anything directly, it's unlikely they'll tear their ACL.
Right, because that twisting, pivoting motion is usually absent in that situation.
Exactly.
So we've covered the physical exam. What about imaging? Do you always get x-rays when you think someone might have ruptured their ACL?
Yes, we do usually get x-rays, but they can't actually show you the ACL rupture itself. X-rays are great for seeing bones, but they don't visualize soft tissues like ligaments very well. However, sometimes x-rays can show you something called a second fracture, which can be a clue that there's an ACL tear. It's a small avulsion fracture, basically. A little piece of bone gets pulled off the outer side of the top of the tibia.
So it's like an indirect sign.
Exactly. While it doesn't show the ACL itself, it's very often associated with an ACL injury.
Yeah.
And it's important to get x-rays anyway because you want to rule out other fractures or injuries to the kneecap that might have happened at the same time.
Makes sense. It's all about getting the full picture. So when do you bring in more advanced imaging, like MRI? What's its specific role in diagnosing cruciate ligament injuries?
MRI, or magnetic resonance imaging, that's our gold standard for diagnosing both ACL and PCL injuries. It gives us a really detailed look at all the structures in the knee. When we look at an MRI, specifically the sagittal view, which is a side view of the knee, we can see if the ACL is torn. You might see the ligament fibers missing altogether, or there might be a clear discontinuity, meaning a break in the ligament. Now, even though we can often have a strong suspicion based on the patient's story in our physical exam, the main reason we get an MRI isn't just to confirm that the ACL is torn.
So it's more than just a confirmation tool.
Right. It's crucial for ruling out other injuries that might have happened at the same time, like tears in the menisci, those C-shaped pieces of cartilage in the knee, or other ligament injuries, and even fractures that might not show up on an x-ray. And in the Orthopedia chapter, figure 5, which is from Radiopedia, shows you exactly what a torn ACL looks like on an MRI.
That's helpful. Speaking of other injuries, are there specific types of cartilage injuries that often accompany an ACL tear?
Yes, there is one that we see quite often. It's called a kissing contusion. This is essentially a bone bruise, and it happens on the surfaces of both the tibia and the femur, where they come into contact with each other. Basically, when the ACL is torn, the tibia can move abnormally, and this sometimes causes the outer part of the top of the tibia, which we call the lateral tibial plateau, to slam into a specific spot on the femur. The sulcus terminalis.
Ouch, that sounds painful.
It is. Mm. And what's interesting is that sometimes the ACL tear itself might not be perfectly clear on the MRI, but if you see this kissing contusion pattern, it's a strong sign that an ACL rupture happened.
So it's like a telltale sign.
Exactly.
Okay, now let's imagine a patient comes in with that classic story. A twisting injury, they heard a pop, they have pain, and their knee is swollen. But on top of that, they can't fully straighten their knee. Why is that a concerning sign? What should we be thinking about?
If someone can't fully extend their knee after an injury like that, especially with those other symptoms, it makes us worry about a displaced bucket handle tear of the meniscus.
I've heard of that, but could you explain it a bit more?
Sure. Basically, what happens is that a part of the torn meniscus flips over inside the joint. It's like the handle of a bucket flipping up, and it gets stuck in a position that blocks the knee from straightening all the way.
Ah, I see. That's why it's called a bucket handle tear.
Exactly. This often requires surgery, and quickly, not just to get that piece of meniscus out of the way and let the knee straighten, but also to try to repair what's left of the meniscus. That meniscus is really important for the long-term health of the knee joint.
So it's not something you want to wait on. Now, shifting gears a bit, let's talk about what people can do to potentially reduce their risk of getting an ACL injury. Are there things people can change or control?
Absolutely. There are definitely things people can do. Now, some risk factors are just part of who you are. We can't change things like being a teenager, being female, or playing certain high-risk sports. But one of the biggest risk factors that we can address is weak hamstring muscles.
The hamstrings, those are the muscles at the back of the thigh, right?
That's right. They play a crucial role in controlling the knee and keeping it stable. They're especially important for resisting that forward movement of the tibia. If your hamstrings are weak, or if they get tired, they might not be able to do their job properly. That puts more stress on the ACL, making it more likely to tear.
So strong hamstrings equal a happy ACL.
Pretty much. That's why ACL injury prevention programs focus on strengthening those muscles around the knee, especially the hamstrings, and making sure they can keep working even when you're tired. And it's not just about being strong, it's about being smart, too. Maybe skip that last run down the ski slope if your legs are feeling fatigued.
That's great advice. Strength and smarts, I like that. Now, if someone does end up completely tearing their ACL, how do we typically manage that? Is the treatment pretty straightforward?
Well, it's not a simple answer, unfortunately. The best way to treat a complete ACL rupture really depends on the individual. There are a lot of factors to consider, probably more than we can cover in detail right now.
Right, it's not a one-size-fits-all situation.
Exactly. But generally speaking, a torn ACL won't heal on its own with our current medical capabilities. So for people who want to go back to doing things that put a lot of stress on their knees, like sports that involve cutting and pivoting, surgery is usually recommended. But it's not a repair, it's more of a replacement.
What do you mean by that?
So in surgery, we don't try to sew the torn ACL back together. It just doesn't heal reliably that way. Instead, we replace it with a new piece of tissue called a graft. And that graft can come from the patient themselves, often from their patellar tendon, hamstring tendons, or quadriceps tendon. Or we can use donor tissue, which is called an allograft.
So when we say ACL repair, it's actually more of an ACL reconstruction.
That's a much better way to put it, yes. And it's worth mentioning that this idea that ACLs don't heal comes with the caveat with today's technology. Who knows what the future holds? Maybe someday we'll be able to repair these ligaments directly.
That's true. Medical science is always advancing. Okay, I think this has been a fantastic deep dive into the world of ACL and PCL injuries. Let's recap 5 key terms that we've covered today, just to solidify our understanding.
Great idea.
First up, the anterior cruciate ligament, or ACL.
Let's break that down. Anterior tells you it attaches to the front of the tibia, and its main job is to resist forward movement of the tibia. Cruciate tells you it crosses with the PCL inside the knee joint. And ligament is simply a tough band of fibrous tissue that connects two bones.
Next, the posterior cruciate ligament, or PCL.
Similar to the ACL, posterior tells you it attaches to the back of the tibia and stops it from sliding backward. Cruciate, again, means it crosses, and ligament still means it connects bone to bone.
Our third term is the Lachman test.
Right. This is the physical exam technique where the examiner tries to move the tibia forward while stabilizing the femur. We're feeling for the quality of the endpoint, checking for that firm stop that tells us the ACL is intact.
And the fourth term is hemarthrosis.
Hemarthrosis means there's blood inside the knee joint. This could be a clue that there's an injury, but it can also make the physical exam a bit tricky because a large amount of blood can make the knee feel artificially stable.
And finally, the kissing contusion.
That's the bone grooves we see on MRI, on both the tibia and the femur, where they've impacted each other because of the ACL tear. Even if the tear itself isn't totally clear on the MRI, that kissing contusion is a pretty strong indicator.
Excellent review. And for our listeners, remember, we've just skimmed the surface here. Yes. To really get the full picture, make sure you check out the entire cruciate ligaments chapter in Orthopedia.
Absolutely.
It's a fantastic resource, and it goes into much more detail.
We've been talking about a chapter from the free and peer-reviewed textbook, Orthopedia, at www.orthopedia.com, edited by Bernstein, Penny, and Vayette. But before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us to read the book. You'll be glad you did.
Couldn't agree more.